Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. We are nearing the end of the season, 2023. There's essentially only one tournament left to go that counts for points in the 52-week ranking. I was about to say 52-year, but anyhow, which is just the ATP Finals, but the WTA Finals has already happened, and we are in Billie Jean King Cup week. But we are here to talk a little bit about like what happened during the last tournament of the year on the WTA side, which actually got to define a lot of things in the WTA rankings, with Iga Świątek finally getting back up on top as the world number one. I think she needed to actually win the title to become number one, and Sabalenka needed to not reach a certain point, I believe, maybe finals or semifinals. Everything just got, well, actually, never mind, she reached the semifinals. But anyhow, everything kind of worked together for Iga Świątek. Everything literally, because she played some of her best tennis, maybe of the year, reminiscent of like her 2022 super dominance. Some people would say even better due to competition and all things like that. But I'm here with Vansh, and we're going to tackle some of that. How are you doing, man?
Yeah, doing good. The WTA Finals was interesting in terms of the players. I mean, I have to say these players have performed really well throughout the whole season. So I was pretty excited to see kind of who would come on top, come out on top. And then obviously you had the number one ranking at stake as well. And, you know, for most of the season, it was Aryna Sabalenka who was having great results and going deep in all the majors. And she had won her first major in Australia. But this WTA Finals was really going to come down to the race for number one, but also who of these players is going to, you know, stand out. Because, like, honestly, if you had told me before the tournament, I would have picked a lot of these players to go pretty deep. And so we end up having a decent semifinal lineup with obviously Goff coming out of the group stages, US Open champion, and playing against... We had Goff coming through, we had Sabalenka coming through, we had Świątek coming through, and Pegula as well. And Pegula was super consistent throughout the season. So we ended up having Sabalenka versus Iga in the semis is when the tournament really ignited in the WTA Finals, because the winner of that was basically going to have a huge outcome in the year-end number one. Because if Sabalenka wins that match, then she's year-end number one. If Świątek wins the semi and wins the final, then she's year-end number one. So it was, you know, she basically had to beat Sabalenka in order to do it. And she did so in a very convincing, dominant fashion. And it was quite a display from Świątek all week, really. And on the other side, it was for Pegula as well. She beat so many of the top players. She beat world number one, two, and three on the way to the final. So it was pretty impressive from her. And both these players were super dominant on their return. They were both hardly losing any games. En route to these matches, just handling the conditions overall a lot better. And the conditions this time of the year in Cancun, with the way the tournament was set up, super bouncy courts and extremely windy, extremely rainy. It's near a beach and it's outdoors. So a lot of rain delays, a lot of just start and stop and play, a lot of high gust winds. And these conditions were brutal. So at times it affected the quality of tennis, but I was very... I felt bad for the players because it was just very tough for them to keep dealing with it. And it's almost impossible. If you've ever played in the wind, you know it's almost impossible to play good tennis in those conditions or play anywhere near. And so the quality was was really up and down and at times not great, but not the player's fault. It's really just the conditions made it almost impossible. But I think it really helped Świątek, the fact that she her footwork is so amazing, how she's able to run get herself around those balls, how she's able to stay super low with her feet and the little adjustment steps that she makes. She has the heaviest forehand in the game as well, and how she's able to put that extra topspin on it, extra safety, RPMs. And, it was just very dominant from her. But also she showed a great deal of adaptability throughout the whole week in those conditions, playing against big hitters. And she never really looked like she was on her back foot that much. And every time she was, she relied on her amazing defense and athleticism to get her way out of points. And I thought serving a lot better. So we saw some things, I want to say, in Beijing and the U.S. and the WTA finals that really showed that Iga's improved again as a player. We didn't think that was possible, because as great as Świątek's 2022 was, 2023 was great, but she had won Roland Garros, but up until that point hadn't won a WTA 1000 yet, and obviously was disappointed in her round four loss at the U.S. Open to Ostapenko. And at that time, it seemed like year-end number one was not necessarily a goal that was all that attainable. Like, in the sense, she could do it, but it would just mean that she'd have to be perfect basically through the end of the season. And she ended up losing in Tokyo to Kudermetova, and that could have really set her back. Those really fast, ultra fast conditions in Tokyo, not really finding her range or timing the first week, but then she comes out, she wins Beijing, adapts herself to the conditions. And obviously here you had higher bouncier courts, they really took Iga's kick serve very well, especially her second serve. And I thought, she just played extremely well. And the final was one of the best performances I've ever seen. Semis and finals were two of the most singularly great performances you'll ever see for one player. And sometimes it's actually quite great to watch someone in that mode. I always root for competitive matches. I want to see really great tennis that goes down to the wire, third set. But at the same time, when you have all-time greats like Świątek already is, it's kind of great. I kind of take joy in seeing them in beast mode as well, because you kind of have those like singularly great individual performances where it's really all about them.
Yeah.
But
it just makes you think at times like, oh, like what can you do? Like, there isn't much. I will say that I think I tweeted that as well. I think Pegula didn't play her best match of the week. Again, like, as you said, like, I don't blame her. The week was also really rough. I think it was probably just really rough, like, psychologically as well as physically, just because obviously you had to do a lot of the stuff. And when you're playing to win as a professional, I guess you have to flow a lot less in terms of like how you're expecting the shot to come and like the bounce. Things can change midair.
The bounce was a big thing for Pegula, because throughout the whole week she was used to playing hitters that were always kind of, either hitting it much flatter or harder, and she was able to kind of absorb their pace. Yeah. Very nicely, but Świątek's ball is just different. Like, it comes at you differently with the, and not only the MPHs, but also the RPM. I think that's like really different. I heard an interview from her before where she mentioned that Świątek almost plays, like, her ball is so heavy, it reminds her of some of the male players on the ATP.
Wow.
And I definitely see that comparison, just because of how heavy her ground strokes are, and that when she is able to get the ball above Pegula's strike zone, it becomes really difficult for Pegula to like control the ball in those conditions. And honestly, I think she just came up against Iga on an absolutely spectacular day where
for sure
just could not, because I think, throughout the whole week, she showed a good amount of mental to me. And I think, I think she can be happy about her week overall and just kind of forget about the final.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
100%. It's not like she matches up very poorly against Świątek. She's beaten her twice this year, and they've had some close matches in the past, last year at the US Open. And I was there for the San Diego semifinal as well. I just think these conditions were just really great for Świątek.
Yeah.
And it was Iga in her finals mode, where she just was so locked in, so focused every single point, where it was just it was just really hard for anybody to contend with that version.
Exactly. And all that to say as well that while I do think that Pegula didn't play her best, I feel like Świątek was not in a mode to like let anybody try to play her best. Like, I feel like Świątek kind of saw that and just saw the opportunity. Like, she didn't try to be spectacular in that regards. Like, she didn't go for like flashy winners or anything. She just kind of went for the strategy and realized that big targets, like, realized that Pegula was misfiring a few shots and maybe just increased even like more the RPMs on the forehand, just make it even more comfortable for Pegula to play. And it was visibly like Pegula's frustration in that match. Like she couldn't find her best game for X amount of reasons, Świątek being a beast, one of them. I think I tweeted as well that on the Dennis and Pegula's account that Świątek is insanely good. Like seriously, like she's a phenomenal player. And I think that even though she didn't reach the heights of 2022, she got pretty close, to be fair. Like she got a Grand Slam, which is really great, and she did pretty well like in the WTA finals winning. She technically won two major titles, and this is not majors, but like she won two really big titles. One fewer 1000s that she did last year. I think she won like four or five. She won four in a row, I believe, last
year.
Yeah,
I think it was going to be impossible for her to
put
a seven match win streak, like win eight titles. I mean, she still won six, and she won one in every level. So yeah. She won a 250, she won two 500s.
Yeah.
She won the 1000 in Beijing. She obviously defended her Roland Garros, which was big. I said going into this year that if she was to win one major, that would be a very good year. Because I knew that the rest of the tour would step up. And that's what happened. Like the top 10 got better. The field overall was stronger. So to me, it's more impressive this year because it's just in so many ways, the fact that she was able to win even more matches than she did last year. She was 67 wins and 9 losses last year. This year, she's 68 wins and 11 losses.
Yeah.
And most of her losses have come either to the eventual winner or like in Wimbledon where she lost to Svitolina, who was like on fire that week.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and you know, she made improvements on grass. She got to the quarters there, and you look at all of her best results, even in the hard court swing when she wasn't playing her best, she still ended up losing to Pegula and Goff, you know, in hard-fought matches. And obviously Ostapenko the next. And then the ways that she was able to overcome the Sabalenka hurdle here, I think it just makes her player of the year, because if I compare her to Sabalenka, apart from Sabalenka having the deep runs in the majors, in the couple of semis and one more final, the rest of the season, overall, week in and week out, it was still Świątek for me as the best player in 2023. And I think to do that after all the expectations of last season and this being like her backup season after everything last year, like it's just she needed to win the WTA finals for me to like cement that. But now that she's done it, it's like, okay, like deserving world number one, year and number one, deserving player of the year. And kind of like, there's like no debate anymore. Like it's... Because normally, sometimes, like, it's kind of interesting if they all win one major or they all... Like, we still had four different major winners, but I think she really separated herself in terms of winning this title.
I think in terms of, like, how we compare with last year, and that it's a comparison that I don't really like to make because those are two completely different situations, but, like, she was a clear player of the year last year. I think Sabalenka did get close this year. I think, as you're saying, like, I feel like the WTA finals really just cemented the position, just where in the end is like, oh yeah,
also winning two of the five, like to win two of like the WTA finals isn't a major, but in terms of points, in terms of prestige, you're playing a top eight player like every other day. So in terms of winning that, I think it really counts as like, you could say like two of the five biggest tournaments were won by
each. Exactly.
And the fact that I think they played each other three times and she got the better of Sabalenka twice, that just kind of, I guess, would further like strengthen her case.
For sure, yeah. I think, I don't think there is a discussion to be had in terms of like whether Świątek is the player of the year. Although I do feel like it's good to see that Sabalenka put up a really big fight for that position.
Yeah. I mean,
and
it's really impressive that she even got to number one and held it for 8 to 10 weeks. You consider where Sabalenka was at last year.
Yeah.
I mean, when she couldn't get a serve in at the start of the season and she struggled with those woes and the amount of improvements that she made technically, physically, and like psychologically throughout this whole the whole off season, you know, bringing someone in like biomechanics, fixing her the technique, the hitches on her serve, and the kind of tennis she was playing in Australia, and then to lead the race this whole time until the WTA finals over Świątek, like obviously winning the Madrid final, which was a very very high quality match from both of them, at various points, and then like. Just like the consistency is not something I would have associated with Sabalenka before the start of the year. Like, go semifinals or better at all five of the biggest events is really, really something like that hasn't happened before since since 2006, Justine Henin made the semis or better of all four majors in the WTA finals. So been like 17 years that someone has done that in the same season. So Sabalenka, for her, like in terms of her it being the career best season, and in terms of it being like something that she could still definitely, you know, win more big titles. Mm-hmm. So that's, and maybe even get the number one again at some point. But just the fact that she was able to get it in for 8 weeks,
yeah,
when Świątek had that much of a lead after last year, is, yeah, it just speaks to how much she's improved.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Sabalenka beat Świątek last year in the WTA finals, right?
In the semi-final match, yes.
Yeah. Yep. And just to correct a previous thing from the last episode that we got pointed out, Garcia won WTA finals last year, and not, yes, Sabalenka. And I think, I don't know if I said it, but it doesn't matter. Garcia did win. It wasn't her best follow-up season, but yeah. It's...
I guess that would be a good, that would also be a good case that, you know, it is possible to carry the form over to the next year. Because, yeah, like Sabalenka, even though she lost in the final, she still got to the final, and
yeah,
it was probably her best result of the whole year last year. And then, like, the fact that she was able to take that and then win the warm-up tournament into Australia and then win the Australian Open.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good, because sometimes, like, the year-end finals has felt like a little bit of a curse for the next year. But yeah, that is also counterexample. So I would say Sabalenka is probably the counterexample to it, and then maybe Ash Barty as well.
Yeah. And I think the prospects are good, like, especially since how much we spoke about the conditions of, like, Cancun tournament. I think Sabalenka and Świątek could meet in the Australian Open next year, I think that would be a really interesting matchup.
They would. Like, the rivalry itself has been very fun to follow. Like, they've played each other 9 times, and it's, mm-hmm, it's 6-3 in favor of Iga, but they've split their last 4 matches.
Yeah.
And also, like, it's, you know, it's just like the level of ball striking and intensity really stands out when they play each other, even if the match is one-sided. I always feel like it's a really fun match to watch. Because actually the semis and finals, the wind did die down a little bit. Like, the conditions were more playable.
Mm.
So the quality of tennis improved, even if the score lines didn't show it. So that was at least better that it kind of finished with those key matchups that we really wanted. Because, like, Sabalenka and Iga playing each other in that match with all the stakes being what they were, like, that's what you want in a competition like this with all the best players. Like,
exactly. You want
there to be the highest stakes. And it felt big. Like, there was a lot of hype going into the match. And we thought we'd see them play many more times after Madrid. But it just, like, never really happened. They always, like, lost one round before each other. And, you know, like, you want to see, like, that rivalry and also clash of personality. And I think it's, like, it's all there because, like, yeah, like, Iga has to, like, make the adjustment to finally play someone who hits, you know, heavier and harder than,
mm-hmm,
than most players. And then, like, Świątek has to kind of counter that. And in the past, like, against the very big hitters, like, Ostapenko, Rybakina. Sometimes it's possible when Świątek is not feeling her best to kind of feel like she has to fight fire with fire and try to out-hit them at their own game. But I think Świątek really made those adjustments and realized that she can rely on her ability to be so tough to get the ball by, kind of like how Goff did in the last 2 sets of the US Open final against Sabalenka. And then it can frustrate Sabalenka and force her to go for bigger and go for more, especially in conditions. And she also had probably was thinking a lot about the number one. And
it's definitely
something more relaxing about being the chaser and being the one, like, because after Świątek held the ranking for 75 weeks, I think it really helped her that she wasn't number one again. Because like, just to find that hunger to improve as a player, that motivation to, like, feel like, okay, I have to chase someone down. But at the same time, it's not the top of my mind. It's at the back of my mind, but I can just focus on, like, what do I have to do in these hurricane conditions, like, point by point after point. And I think she's kind of good at doing that, like, the intensity and, like, when she's locked in, it reminds me a lot of some of the very, very all-time greats, like Steffi Graf or, like, Rafael Nadal when he's dominating on clay. Like, it's just that relentless footwork and intensity.
Yeah. I forget what I was going to say, but, yeah, it was in line with that. Yeah, just excited to see more of, like, Świątek and Sabalenka. I think maybe this is going to be something about Sabalenka after losing the U.S. Open final. Always a little bit harder to make too many adjustments at the end of the season. Things are kind of, like, trying to not necessarily slow down, but, like, sort of, like, looking forward to end. There's, like, a mental and psychological, even physical fatigue that's starting to build up towards the end. But I think the next season, it might show sort of like some of the same that Świątek did this year in terms of adjusting to big hitters and styles of play. I think Sabalenka has the opportunity to show some of that as well, like to hit past big defenders as well, which kind of has proven like a good strategy against her, which is not an easy one because Sabalenka hits really hard. But if you're as fast as Goff or Świątek, it's definitely something that you can keep up. You also have to be fit for this to work, but you can, if you can get in her head, that's something that is a strategy that is worth trying. And I'm excited to see like how she's going to try to combat that, like in the future. She's going to try to hit, try to finish points more at the net. She's going to try to like use more spin, more slices, like more drop shots, like add some variation, like just, you know, something that she might want to try to change. But it's going to be interesting to see like what she and her team come up with.
It will be, yeah, because she's certainly a capable volleyer.
Mm-hmm.
And she's obviously like she's done a good job in terms of like her transition game in doubles, when she's won slams, and finishing points at dent. But she obviously prefers to be the one dictating from the back of the court and prefers to finish points up there. It would be interesting to see if she uses a few more angles,
mm-hmm.
and, like tries to hit behind her opponent a little bit more and not force the issue so much. I think sometimes she falls into that trap where her footwork and balance is just is not always fully there. So like she was taking these really, really big swings, but sometimes like the little adjustment steps and the footwork or like the backswing is just not quite in sync. And that can obviously happen when you're playing somebody who is like chasing every single thing down and getting it back deep, like right at your feet. And it's like those little like quick reactions. But it could also be like kind of a mental thing, because if she takes a little bit off, like 10-15% off, and then just gets a little bit more safety, that would, like we've seen her do in the past. But if she's just playing like first strike tennis, the whole time, like she will against most players. She will get the chance to do that. So it's just it will be interesting to see like mentally how she deals with the latter stages of these events, knowing that she did it already once.
Yeah.
That should give her confidence, but also like the first half of next year is where she has a lot of points to defend with the Madrid title and the Indian Wells final, the Australian Open final, the Australian Open title, of course. So at this point, it would feel really good for Iga, because she'll go into these off-season with more weeks, and then also just potentially she's the one with a lot to gain having lost in the fourth round last year to Rybakina, which is in some ways a pretty tough draw, because Rybakina was really not playing like whatever she was ranked at that time.
Mm, yeah.
But because of like the Wimbledon points, she was ranked outside the top 10. So
yeah, which is actually really great to see that she was able to follow that up.
Of course, it would be fun to see Świątek. It would be fun to see Świątek and Ostapenko play each other again. Świątek and Rybakina. I mean, Ostapenko and Rybakina seem to be the biggest challenges for Świątek right now, like the flatter, harder hitters.
Yeah. And a huge serve as well.
Yeah, huge serve, huge return, because against Rybakina, like, she just doesn't let you get that first strike that Iga's usually looking for in those really fast conditions in Australia. So it's going to be fun to see like how Świątek handles that, and if, you know, because she's also like always tinkering and improving and doesn't really like leave a stone unturned when it comes to honing in the game and working on a few more things. I saw her hit a few more drop shots even against Jabari.
Yeah.
And actually she was a player who used to hit with a lot more variety before 2021 or 2022, believe it or not, Świątek. Like when you watched her win the French Open in 2020, she was actually using a lot more slices and drop shots and kind of doing, mixing things up. And then sort of after that, she's become predominantly a baseliner.
Yeah.
But it seems like by all accounts, they're always working on stuff in practice and trying to change things up and just give herself a little bit more options when she's playing, when she's getting out hit sometimes. But yeah, the second serve sometimes can be talked about as a bit of a weakness for Świątek, but I will say in conditions like this, it's a bona fide strength for her. Like the bouncy, high bouncing courts in the like especially on clay and also in conditions like slower conditions like this, it's really hard to put her on the defense after she hits a second serve because it's pretty effective.
Yeah, for sure.
It's usually out of the opponent's strike zone.
And if you want to listen to a more detailed account of Świątek's win at the WTA Finals, you can actually go because Varsh has a different podcast as well with Damian Kust, who's been a guest on this podcast before. Shout out to Damian and his Challenger Tour coverage, which is amazing. Should give him a follow.
Yes.
And you should give a follow as well to Iga and Carlos, the podcast that Varsh is also a part of. And they went into a deep dive of her WTA Finals.
Every single, basically talked about all five matches and what stood out and how she, the different game plans that she used in all five. But, you know, basically she just, it was her adaptability that really stood out. It was her ability to defend. It was the dominance behind her serve and also just, the ruthlessness and the mentality that we saw. So kind of already covered like in pretty good detail here, but check out that podcast because that's an Iga and Carlos one that Damien and I have started about 6 months ago, and it's going well so far. Damien is such a pleasure to host these with because his knowledge of every single player basically in the top 500 is always unparalleled, so definitely give him a follow.
Yeah, for sure. And if you've guessed it, it's Iga and Carlos because the podcast is mainly about Iga Świątek and Carlos Alcaraz, the leading players of the next generation in WTA and ATP, something like that. That's sort of like your tag for the...
Basically like generational talents kind of achieving big things at the same time. It's fun to kind of chronicle their careers and, you know, look back on it like maybe 10, 15 years later and then just see because I think they're very similar in terms of how they approach the game, like what their strengths are, even though they're on opposite tours and just, them achieving these things at the same time. So it's kind of cool to chronicle their careers and then talk big picture about the rest of the tour through their lens. So it's exciting. We've done about 14 episodes. It's not the most regular show. It's usually when they're playing their tournaments and they don't play a whole lot of tournaments compared to everyone else because when they do play, they win a lot. So that definitely helps contribute to it as well. So when we do an episode, then we usually have quite a bit to talk about. But also, like, I'm very impressed by Pegula in terms of the season that she put up to finish the year in the top five, to do everything that she's doing in doubles along with Coco. I think at some point it just it's just so impressive that she played over 130 matches in singles and doubles and kind of week in and week out, like no one is really grinding like her on the tour. And the run that she had to the final was absolutely amazing in terms of the beating Sabalenka and Rybakina in the round robin group, and the way she was able to do that in straight sets and taking the ball so early on return and just playing very, very smart and throwing in slices, coming to the net at times, like just some of the best tennis I've ever seen her play in her career, and pretty dominant. And and then also her interviews are such a pleasure for me to watch because she's so real, you know?
It's just so real
and relatable, even though, you know, obviously, like, she comes from a very elite, like, financial background, but you just wouldn't know that when you talk to her because it's just, like, very real and down to earth. And I'm pretty sure that, like, no one has a bad word to say about her in terms of...
Yeah. I love her demeanor. Like,
ambassador.
When she's a... when she gives interviews, when she answers questions, when she talks to people, even her Twitter is really funny.
Oh, it's hilarious. Like, after the final, she put up this amazing thing on Instagram where she was just like, I got taken by the Iga bakery factory today, lol, or something. And it's just like, you know, it's cool. Like, she has a very good sense of humor, and she's in the player council, and she's just, she has such a great personality. And so she's like one of my favorite players to listen to and to watch as well, because there's a lot of like subtleties in her game. Like, if you just watch her on TV, you wouldn't think that she's hitting the ball so hard, but it's very accurate. It's very deep, very hard, flat. The strokes, the way they're able to penetrate through. The problem was against Iga on this court in this matchup, it was just going to be really difficult for her to get that timing and control right. But I think like this should give her a lot more confidence to kind of break that quarterfinal hurdle.
I was going to say.
In majors and also like see what happens if she cuts back on the doubles, which I think she's planning on doing. I saw an interview from her.
I think Kerr and Coco are willing to cut more through.
They wanna continue their same plan until the Olympics because they wanna, you know, go for that gold.
Mm.
But after that, I think it makes sense, especially where they're both at in their careers. And they're like 10 years apart, but they have such a great relationship and they're like, just double threats and they both get mixed as well. So I mean, like it's not very usual that you have like two players in the top five in singles, like also do the same in doubles and like contend for these titles every single week. So
I don't know
how she's playing so much, but it's...
I think it probably helps in the sense that knowing Coco so much and like having good partnership and like in doubles, I think they're able to kind of like take it easy on that in that regard. Like not necessarily that they don't put the effort in, but I think it probably becomes easier to play like with a partner. And like doubles, you're essentially always kind of like running less and doing a little bit less effort in that regard. And they being good singles players as well, they do hold a bit of an advantage off the ground in doubles. Like that's one of the main things that you see, like if singles are performing well, is mostly because they're able to push the double specialists off of the net. So like if the double specialist cannot get to the net and be able to control the point from there, it gets harder for them because most of the time they don't have the best of the baseline games. So it becomes a little difficult. And that's why, like, but it not to say that double specialists aren't great players in doubles as well. Like, it's not like a singles player can just come in and just win every time. But
Krejcikova.
Yeah.
For as an example.
Yeah. But yeah, and on that note, I think I was really happy for Dabrowski this year, going in with Erin Rublev, qualifying for the WTA finals, reaching the semifinals. I think may have been the first time that they did, so I haven't checked, or also maybe not. But anyhow, I was a little upset they didn't make it all the way, but they won all three matches in the round robin, so that's really good. I think it could be interesting, like, for this partnership in the future. I know doubles isn't the most liked part of tennis, I guess, but it's fun. I would recommend people watch at least around the semifinal stages of big tournaments. It's normally kind of like a lot of fun to do. Yeah,
it's very fun to watch live in person.
Yeah, that too.
It's a very good in terms of. I mean, I really enjoyed playing it when I was younger in juniors, and I found it really helped my singles game at times.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it can be just very good in your off days as well, like when you don't have to. If you don't, you know, you can use that as kind of a way to warm up or work on things in your singles that is like pretty transferable, like returns and, you know, quick reaction time and volleys and also just like the chemistry with someone else who you have to adapt your game style according to the dynamics of the team. So, there's quite a lot of benefits to it. And on the WTA, you also have a lot of crossover where like you have Krejcikova and Yakova, both pretty good at singles, and then Pagula Goff as well. And then, like some of these doubles teams, you know, like it's actually like getting quite deep. It's pretty hard to like crack the top eight nowadays in both disciplines. So
yeah, and I guess speaking of
also just a pretty good season also for Goff.
Yeah,
in the singles also to get to the semis here. It wasn't her best week. She was never really playing her best tennis this whole time. The serve was kind of all over the place. The forehand was tough when the wind. In terms of dealing with that, she's no longer working with Parariba. So it's just Brad Gilbert now on her team. But I don't know. Like, I mean, it's still a very, very good year. Like to US Open, win Cincinnati, win Washington, like that whole summer, the summer of Coco. And then basically cement her place in the top four. And, you know, the rivalry with Swiatek will be fun to follow. It sort of went back to the pre-Cincinnati times, the twice that they played in Beijing and here. Actually, she started to play really well in the second set against Swiatek in their round-robin match. She actually served for the second set at 5-4, but then unfortunately in that wind, in those conditions, she got broken back. She hit four double faults, which had to have felt pretty brutal and demoralizing. And then we ended up losing, but I honestly thought after that it would be pretty tough for her to recover. But Vondrousova served for the match against her for a straight set win. And it was such a back and forth match, that one, with so many momentum swings, and she ended up beating Vondrousova 6-3 in the third and getting to the semis. And I think by the time the semis happened, she also came up against Pegula, and that matchup is always that matchup is interesting, but at times also a little awkward because they know each other so well.
Yeah,
and they're such good friends, and every time they have to play each other in singles. So far, it's been Pegula who's had the edge 3 out of the 4 times they played. They also played like that one really good match in Montreal, where,
yeah.
which was like Goff's only loss in the summer, and that during that.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Stretch after Wimbledon, but
yeah
I mean, she still got to the semis, so I mean, hats off for getting through it despite like not playing your best tennis.
Yeah, but also Goff said that she prefers Toronto over Montreal, so I'll be happy that Pegula won that one, and that was a joke, but
yeah. Yes, because you're from Montreal, so
yeah, I'm in Montreal, and apparently Pegula's grandma is from Montreal, so wow. What a connection, eh? So that's really good.
Yeah, that's quite something, because if her grandma is from Montreal, her mom is from Seoul, and she's won a title in Seoul and in Montreal this year. So
that's true. She's just been raking up titles wherever she lives. She only needs like the American one, you know.
There's that really cool story about how she was adopted. Her mom was adopted.
Yeah.
She ended up winning that title in Seoul, and her mom. And the orphanage, and she visited that orphanage 4 years ago, and then it basically meant a big deal for her to win that
for sure
trophy.
Yeah.
So I mean, like, the top five is very strong right now. I mean, you have basically Świątek and Sabalenka and Goff and Rybakina and Pegula. So that top five is very good.
Yeah. And speaking of top. But you said before top eight, now you're saying top five, but the top eight. With the ATP has finally got all of their 8 qualifiers for Turin. It got decided in Paris, after Paris, I believe, which is what we are going to chat a little bit about here. Obviously not as big an event as the WTA Finals, so we're not going to spend that much time on this one, but good week, good tennis. Had some of the schedule woes, but I mean, all of this should be somewhat resolved when things switch to a 2-week Masters. I'm not sure if Paris is going to switch to a 2-week.
Yeah, Paris and Monte Carlo are going to remain 1 week.
Yeah, so that's gonna be interesting. Yeah,
it's gonna be interesting. Yeah, it was a little tough on the players, of course, to play 6 matches on that one center court. But I think they'll learn from this and certainly in the future. It was just very ambitious for them to schedule 6 matches. So you had matches finishing at 2:30 in the morning, 4, and then the players not having enough time to recover the next day. Sinner obviously having to pull out because of fatigue. So that was kind of unfortunate for the tournament, because such a good player had to pull out because of, scheduling and some of that. I'm sure they have their reasons, because the second court is not really one that... They basically only have one really good court in the Paris Masters. The other courts are just not big enough or spacious enough to accommodate the ticketing. And then you have the day session and the night session, and you have to get doubles in. So eventually it was tough scheduling wise for those 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the organizers will look at it this for next year and probably do this a little bit differently.
Yeah, and Paris is an established event. Like, it's been running on for so many years now. It's not like they don't know what they're doing. I think It must have been like some sort of like trial. In any case, they still got a pretty good tournament. I mean, Djokovic
won. The matches were fantastic.
Right from the
first few matches itself, like you had, I mean, you obviously, it was unfortunate for those 36 plus year old veterans who all lost on the same day, basically with having match points. But it was also a reminder of, like, I mean, just the fact that they're still playing at such a high level.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you had Andy Murray losing a heartbreaker to Divinor again.
Very rough.
Super brutal. And then you had Divinor. I mean, you had team beating Stan Wawrinka. Wawrinka served for the third set, had match point. You had Monfils losing to Cerundolo. And then you had Gasquet losing to Tommy Paul. And all of them losing to pretty good players in their own right. But it was these matches were just so dramatic. And they went down to the wire and match point saved. And I guess it also kind of reminded me of the things that Murray and Wawrinka and Gasquet and Monfils were able to do this year. And at certain points in the year. And yeah, I mean, it's, even though they're getting towards the end of their careers, they're giving their fans so many moments of a great level, even if it's not always converting to wins right now. It's just a reminder. Like, I saw a stat today that 8 of the top 100 players are 35 plus. So, and
8
and
of the top 100?
Yeah, are 35 plus years old. That's not a lot, but it's still, it's still a lot more than probably previous.
Yeah, for sure.
5 years ago, 10 years ago, it wasn't as common. Obviously, with the big three and what they've done and the whole era, it's they're still playing at a pretty high level. But
yeah, it gives belief, I guess, to players who are like reaching that phase of their lives, and they're kind of getting.
Having a great season overall, because it was just very consistent and always losing to the top players. But finally now he's put together a few weeks where he's beaten Alcaraz, he's beaten Bruna, he's beaten, this week he beat Medvedev, Tsitsipas and Hurkacz all indoors.
Yeah, those are some really good matches. Dimitrov had been playing very good tennis, honestly. I felt like that was one thing that I really wanted him to do, which was like just kind of take more initiative in points, like be more aggressive. I think he's got good quality in that, like, he's extremely athletic and he likes to defend. Like, he kind of like needs, he kind of has a tendency to stay a bit passive, like, I guess, in his points. But he was taking an initiative when he needed to, when he wanted to. Like, he had a few really good backhand down line winners versus against Tsitsipas. Just taking advantage of the fact that Tsitsipas stays so deep into his backhand corner. That, like,
he was so good in that third tiebreak.
Yeah,
it's supposed. I mean, the passing shots he was coming up with on the run, on the forehand, and basically had no inroads into the Tsitsipas serve in the third set the whole time. I think Tsitsipas had won 20 out of 23 of his service points. It really looked like he was going to come out on top, but then in the third set, and then also their history, like, of Dimitrov had never had beaten Tsitsipas in a tiebreak ever before. Mm-hmm. They'd put each other 7 times before this, and Tsitsipas was 6-1.
But what a level. From
what a level
that tiebreak,
third set tiebreak. And Tsitsipas, I mean, he just took a couple of loose errors, but Dimitrov played like outstanding. Like, he had this one ridiculous fast shot. And then, the two on the backhand, one on the forehand, the passes. So, 4 really, really good points out of the 7 that he won. And then, you know, obviously serving great. And he stepped up his level in that third set tiebreak when he's not always been known to do that the last 4 or 5 years. He hasn't won a title since 2017. He's lost a lot of semifinals, but for him to come through at 32 and still play at this high level is still pretty impressive. And kind of his season, I felt like, deserved a moment like this, because before this year, I mean, you can look at all of his losses, but it was all pretty much to the top guys, and he was always winning like 2 matches every single week and always putting himself in those positions. So he was kind of playing at a top 15 level, but the results weren't really like showing it, because he wasn't ranked high enough to meet them later in.
Yeah, it's like, just draw is always a tough thing. If you're not ranked super high, you're always going to run into players like that. So,
and since the US Open, I can definitely say he's been playing at a top 10
for sure
level. So that's and then actually getting more of these wins. So that was good to see. I agree with you about like him being more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has such a good backhand slice as well that he just that stays so low, especially on these indoor courts in Paris. It was just skidding and staying so low. It was such a conundrum for these players to deal with. Yeah. And then he's looking to open up the court with his forehand on the next shot. Either go inside in, inside out, come to the net, use his athleticism, defense, and rallies, serve. But against against Djokovic in the final, I felt like it was a combination of him obviously feeling the effects of all those big wins, and then also just the matchup being rough for him.
Yeah,
against someone so complete like Djokovic, it was just. I mean, Djokovic wasn't at his best this whole week either, but he just did what Djokovic always does, and like pretty much just found the way. It's just amazing that he still has this drive and motivation to like keep winning. I mean, obviously he still has like a lot of goals that he wants to achieve. Like this was his 40th, the Masters 1000, 40th. Like it's just,
40th,
some of the numbers are ridiculous. You look at like, this is his 70th big title. Like he's had 97 titles now. Like, you know, Federer had Federer had 103, Connors had 109. So like, I mean, he's going for those records as well. And now it looks like for sure he's going to finish the year number one, because he basically has to win one round robin match regardless of what Alcaraz does during the week. So it's pretty much sealed. Just needs one more win, basically, and then he'll have it for eighth year. Just, seven was already a record, so eight is just extending it. And then it also means he'll be at 400 weeks by the time the year comes around. So yeah, another amazing season where he's 51-5, and so he's won six titles and he's only lost five times. And like in 11 tournaments played, which is just nuts, because he's at a point in his career where he's clearly picking and choosing his spots, because he's you know, he wants to peak for the biggest tournaments. But
I mean, somebody's got to crank up this difficulty in the game, right? Because Djokovic is too good now, his next level.
It is. I mean, and to be honest with you, like Rublev played a very, very good match in the semifinal. Like he played,
he was a good match,
really well. Like it was probably the best tennis that Rublev can play, to be honest. Yeah. Like the way he was hitting the ball so deep on his backhand side, like being so aggressive with it. You know, really the pace that he was. Djokovic made this funny quote like after the match was over. He compared it to like a snake and a frog. It was something about like the snake suffocating the frog. It reminded me of like some of those Stephisms,
Tsitsipas
quotes. but basically, like he had never played a version of Rublev who was that good.
Yeah.
Prior to this, those were his words. But obviously, like he wasn't feeling his best in these matches. Like he was going through some back issue at the end of the second set against Rublev, and he had a stomach bug the whole week that he was dealing with. So his match against Griekspoor, he won ugly and ended up winning that in three sets and just raising his level in the clutch moments like he tends to do. Then the match against Rune was probably the most exciting one of the week for me, because Rune obviously beat him in the final here last year from a set down. He's the only player in a Masters final to ever do that to Djokovic, and he has two wins against Djokovic, and he led the head-to-head 2-1, including one match this year in Rome. So, and Rune was a player who was really struggling for form.
But he just shows up against Djokovic. I think Bastien tweeted that. But
and I could see he was playing at a better level already in Basel, getting to the semis there.
Yeah.
Before Felix just dominated him in that semifinal. But then this week he was looking really good up until the quarters, and I knew it was going to be a very, very close match, and it was going to be, because they also play like somewhat very similarly against each other, and Rune doesn't have that many weaknesses. In the kind of matchup and the fabric of the rallies that he likes against Djokovic, and he kind of backs himself and he plays with the kind of confidence. This is what Owen also tweeted, that he plays with the kind of confidence that you wish a lot of young players would against Djokovic, but he also just has that game and well-roundedness that I think can stay with Djokovic. It remains to be seen in best of five, of course, because there's still, like, you know, the physical concerns with Rune with the cramping, and then also just the shot selection at times, but he played a very good match overall. It's just at the start of the third, he clearly felt the fatigue a little bit and, you know, ran out of gas to a certain extent, but he's just kept holding serve as well. Yeah. So his serve is very good indoors as well. And I feel like I've seen him play his best tennis indoors. Obviously last year and then also this year.
Yeah,
but Djokovic, to get through Griekspoor, Rune, Rublev, all without playing his best, and even in the final, I'll be honest, he didn't play his best.
Yeah,
but he didn't do anything really all that spectacular in the final.
Yeah,
he just got one more ball back super deep, forced Dimitrov into a lot of errors, and Dimitrov felt like he had to overplay a lot of the time.
Yeah,
and
he got out of a hole a bit in the final game, I believe. Dimitrov, I think, had a break point in 5-4 in the third, in
so
the second
that's the
set.
Only game that I felt like he really had a
You had to work.
To do something was the final game of the first set, but you got to do.
Oh, yeah. That was that one. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, maybe he can get to a break point here. Maybe, yeah, you know, this match can start to change a little bit. But it never really looked like it because,
yeah,
the, you know, I also thought Djokovic did such a good job of dealing with Dimitrov's slice.
Yeah. He kind of has his a great slice of his own. So I think he was able to maneuver that as well.
Which is not something he had, I would say, in his game, like, well, throughout his career.
No, absolutely not.
But like, now he's even good at that, too. Like, there's just not... because, like, that's how Dimitrov usually, like, he breaks your contact point. He hits the slice super low, and then he sets it up with the forehand. But Djokovic is like, my backhand is good enough that most of the time I don't need a slice. When I do slice, I'll slice back really, really deep, and I'll just neutralize their slices. Yeah. Yeah. And so it was just... And then I think the games where he got broken, Djokovic just kind of recognized, I just need to be solid, and Dimitrov will probably overplay here, and he's
feeling 100%
fatigue. And I don't know, like, Djokovic, he can win in just so many different ways. And
he played a lot more of, like, a mental, mature game, which is obvious, it's Djokovic, but it's a lot more so than he needed to do, like, actual shot making, which is, a shame for Dimitrov in that specific matchup. But as you said, like, it's always tough, right, against a guy like Djokovic.
And then there was that moment after the match where he was in tears and crying, and I think he was just upset that he couldn't put together a better level in that final.
For sure, yeah.
But then Djokovic stopped in the middle of his post-match interview and then went and consoled him, and like, I think he kind of realized also that he's been in those situations also a little bit himself.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Where he's not played his best in a final, or he's had like a very big week that's physically exhausting, and then just didn't show up for that final match. But I don't know, like, Dimitrov was one of those really good stories where it's just, like, he's a very good guy, he works super hard, he's obviously been number 3 in the world before, he's had success, but nobody really believed deep down that he could do this again so consistently, and so that he could do this again is a feel-good week.
Yeah, I mean, Djokovic is a guy who's been winning for so long now that we forget that, like, back in that time between, like, 2006 up until 2010, he was, you know, losing some of those big matches, like, consistently enough. He won a few of his big ones. He was number 3 for a reason, but he did take a few of his losses against Federer and Nadal, like, in his day. So he knows what it is to lose, I guess, like, in a big moment like that.
Yeah, and then he had those years between 2012 and 14 where he won one major every season, but...
Yeah.
No, he was losing, like, those major finals. Like, he lost a couple in 2013 to Nadal, and lost some bigger matches, like the Olympics. So, he's also been in situations where he's lost more finals than he'd won. Like, at one point, he was 6 and 7 in major finals, and then he just completely turned that around. And it's insane because, like, the older you get, the less clutch you're supposed to get. Like, if you're a normal, like, just a normal great, you know?
Yeah.
Even if you're just a normal great, but Djokovic is just... so insanely, like, I'm kind of running out of superlatives in terms of like how consistently, like,
it's just different. Like, honestly, the Benjamin Button of tennis.
Whereas it's just he's almost like in his prime right now, which is it sounds ridiculous. And like in some cases, he's like, I always struggle with the question, like, is he a better player now than he was 10 years ago? Like, I think the better way to put it is he's more complete and evolved, than he was. Sure, maybe he's like a touch less explosive. Maybe he's a touch less this thing. But if it is, it's not like very noticeable compared to even like, you know, his peers like Federer and Nadal. It was more noticeable when they were 36, 37. But this guy is just like, it looks like he has 2 more really good years in him.
Yeah.
And just the way he takes care of his body and the way he's like peaking and taking time off. Like, these breaks don't seem to like really affect his win rate, you know, which is like... kind of unheard of. He has the luxury to do it, but it's just like the rate at which he's winning these big titles. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. And I think one of the things that you said, like, just to go back before a few players and names you've mentioned, I think a big shout out as well to Tsitsipas as well for like coming through. Hasn't had like the best of seasons. Still a good one in a few ways. Australian Open final as well. He's gotten there. I was going through like a bit of a difficult time, like second half of the season especially. But I think he played some of the best tennis like all year, like honestly, in Paris as well. I think he was also hitting his backhand better, especially off of the slice.
Yes.
But obviously the thing that stands out the most is how much better his confidence was, like in general in his game, but specifically how insanely well he was serving, and his forehand was by far a whole lot better than it's been like in a few other matches in this season. So I think he could be a really interesting like player in Turin as well if he comes in with that same the same confidence. He's been a winner there as well. I think 20, I want to say 2019. That's when he won.
19, yeah, and I agree with you. Like he was playing a lot better this week, and not just this week, like in Vienna as well. He made the semis,
yeah.
And the week before that. So that's three really good weeks that he's put together in the European indoors, which is good, much needed for him because he won Los Cabos, and then he was not in the best moment of his career until, like, basically those next 2 months. Some off court stuff as well with his dad and the coaching switch up and like not having one consistent voice with Filipoussis. Obviously also in a very happy time off the court with his relationship with Paula Badosa, which that seemed to be getting a lot more media attention than his tennis.
Yeah.
So there was that, but honestly, like he also, like, yeah, after the Australian Open, he also had like an injury in February and March. Like,
yeah.
He was playing Indian Wells in Miami, but he wasn't healthy and he just didn't want to get penalized.
Yeah,
so he had that
shoulder injury,
and then I think the Alcaraz, in terms of his clay court season, he lost to Alcaraz in the Barcelona final, and then in Roland Garros quarterfinal, and then I think his grass court season was better with Wimbledon, and then Los Cabos, but really like since Los Cabos to now he just wasn't in the best phase,
yeah.
I would say, but like now he's serving great, his transition game is as good as ever, his forehand is. This is effective, and the backhand doesn't need to be a major strength. It probably won't be, but it just has to hold up. It just has to be sturdy. It just, you know, he has to get it deep. He has to move back on the second serve return. He has to, you know, he was using the slice a lot more this week.
Yeah,
which was good against certain players. Like it worked very well for him against Khachanov, and it worked very well for him against Zverev, because those are both players who are not as comfortable moving inside the court. And It worked very well against him. And even though he didn't win the match against Dimitrov, he showed this level, and he didn't have his best tennis that day, honestly, in the semifinal. Like he kind of played a poor game to lose the first set, to lose serve, and then he was kind of fighting back. But then I actually thought that he would take the match, but it was Dimitrov's outstanding tennis in the third set tiebreak that got over the line.
Stole
but
it away.
His level was very good. So
yeah.
If Tsitsipas carries this level into Turin, depending on which group he's in, and he's won this tournament before, and I don't know, like I just would not rule him out for winning big titles because he still has this level where his forehand is so elite to me that
yeah
it's still it's still a top three forehand in the game.
Yeah, and on
look at it.
Yeah, and it, on indoor courts, I think it's really important. Like the tools that he have are essential, really. Like a big serve, big forehand, I think it's going to be really good for him, like on indoors or on any indoor courts where he's feeling comfortable and confident in his own game. Which is, speaking of, like, I know you were mentioning before we started that like you had like some combinations of players that you wanted to see in the groups and the Turin. Like what are those? Who do you want to see? Like what matchups are you most interested in?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like obviously the thing also is like you know, we also had Alcaraz losing early in the indoors, and it obviously this will be his debut at the ATP final, same with Rona.
Yeah.
So like that's going to be the biggest question mark, is how will they handle their debut? Obviously, where is Alcaraz right now physically as well, because he mentioned he was struggling with the back issue and then also the foot problem. So he said going into Paris I'm not 100%, which didn't look good to me going into that match. And he also just came up against a very talented big hitter who is kind of like Karatsev, and he just takes the ball really early. And Roman Safiulin, that has made a Wimbledon quarterfinal this year, is having a fantastic season inside the top 40. And he caught Alcaraz kind of when Alcaraz wasn't worked into the tournament. And so it was a very good win for Safiulin in that match. But also like Alcaraz indoors this time of the season after a long year, possible that we might not see him get past the group stages.
Yeah.
Because of how strong the field is, and also just where he's been kind of at since the US Open. But I would say in terms of the groups, we know that Alcaraz and Djokovic can be in the same group, and we know that seven and eight can be in the same group. So Rune and Zverev can be in the same group. Sinner and Medvedev can be in the same group because three and four and one and two with Djokovic, Alcaraz have to be in opposite groups. So I was thinking that we've seen Djokovic and Medvedev play already quite this year. I don't know if I want to necessarily see that in a group stage, like kind of again. I'm just trying to think of like new possibilities and new outcomes. Like I would really like to see Sinner play Djokovic.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Because Sinner like has shown quite a lot of improvements against Medvedev. And we've seen that matchup already now twice. And it was great quality tennis, but I'd love to see him in the same group as Djokovic so they play each other in the round robin. So Sinner, Djokovic. I'd honestly like to see Sinner play against Tsitsipas again because they had a very good five-setter at the Australian Open and that went Tsitsipas' way. But, you know, Sinner has improved so much this year and he's had an overall very consistent year and is four and kind of took over Tsitsipas in that fourth spot. So I want to see them play again and see how it would be indoors. So I want Sinner, Tsitsipas, Djokovic, and I would even say Zverev because I want to see Sinner play Zverev again after the US Open match.
Yeah.
Just to see if like he can deploy the same tactics that he did against Medvedev and it work against another counterpuncher, because I'm sure that if he plays at the level that he's at, he's very much capable of beating Zverev also.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see him play Djokovic again after the Wimbledon semi and then also Tsitsipas. So honestly, him being in the same group as his losses in the majors would be another good indicator of just like where he's at. And obviously he wants to peak and do very well because it's in his hometown.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
It's the first time he's actually playing. He qualified in 2021, but he was an alternate.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a very big event for Sinner. And also the fact that he pulled out of Paris with the fatigue, I think he's going to be more well-rested as well. So I expect to see a very good center here, and he could do some serious damage. So that would be one group, and then the next group for me would be Alcaraz, Runa. I want to see them play each other again because they played at Wimbledon, and you know, you just want to see that rivalry.
Yeah. And it wasn't the best representation, I think, of how good it can be. I think Alcaraz is a lot more seasoned, which is funny to say because he's only like 20 years old, but yeah.
Yeah, it definitely did not deliver to the hype their Wimbledon match, for sure. So that's why I want to see that again. And then also Medvedev, because the Medvedev adjustments that he made at the US Open against Alcaraz and the two one-sided matches. So I want to see Alcaraz, Medvedev, Runa in the same group.
Yeah. Who's the one that we're missing? Oh, Rublev. Rublev would be there as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because I want to see Alcaraz, Rublev. They haven't played each other. So that's another one.
That'd be interesting, yeah. Because like Rublev has a forehand that...
Rublev would have to play Medvedev, Alcaraz, and Runa. Rublev and Runa we've already seen twice this year. And both times it was Rublev who came out on top. And clutch those wins. So I want to see that match again. I want to see Rublev against Alcaraz because they've never played. How does that match look like?
Yeah, hopefully the group's actually like that though. I feel like, yeah.
No. So I don't know, and you can flip-flop, like, I don't know, Zverev and Runa because like seven and like one has to play eight first. One either will play seven or eight first and two will either play whichever one didn't get. So
yeah,
like kind of guaranteed to get like either Djokovic versus Zverev in the first day or either Djokovic against Runa the first day. And then same with like Alcaraz is guaranteed to play.
Yeah, Djokovic Runa again would be very interesting, I think. I think it could be really fun. I think it's a lower stakes match if they actually get to reach like first match in a round robin. But I'm pretty sure Runa will be wanting to get the win again, and Djokovic is Djokovic. He doesn't really want to just throw away a win a match just for that. Also, which is by the way, like as you said before, Djokovic is probably going to look for that one win at the very least.
You wouldn't want to stop there. Like if he got that one,
sure, yeah.
Because the thing is that, like you don't know, like even two wins sometimes is not enough to qualify for the semis. It's rare, but it's happened before. So it's like one of those where every game matters, every set matters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a lot of points. Like every round that you win is 200 points, which is more than getting to a fourth round of a slam.
Yeah.
So, like the points and this thing is huge. Like, obviously Djokovic has won this title last year, and like he hadn't won it since 2015 before last year. So he actually like hadn't played his very best at this tournament before, in some years. And then he also is like really gunning for the Davis Cup because he wants to do well at the Olympics, and you know, it's like very important for him to represent Serbia and play his best tennis.
Yeah,
for his country. So yeah, that's going to be interesting. And same with Sinner, actually. Sinner was also in the Davis Cup finals.
Yeah,
could get Djokovic Sinner again in the Davis Cup, and well, also get Djokovic Murray.
Oh yeah! Actually. Oh my gosh! That's a matchup that a lot of people had been wanting before, but now I think they're like less keen. So we'll see what happens. Murray probably like hoping that Djokovic kills himself like in Turin and just plays like only three setters and then just comes in like extremely tired.
We're just like playing the match of his life for
3 minutes
just like, you know, like I'm still excited to see it, even if it's like a one-sided match winning Djokovic. Like just seeing that rivalry again would just bring back so many memories of my childhood.
Sure. And I'm pretty sure the handshake is going to be very cool as well.
Yeah. And especially like them knowing what Djokovic, like knowing what Murray has gone through
for
so many years with his injuries and everything. I'm sure it'll be a cool moment.
And it would also be a big moment for Davis Cup marketing in a sense.
Oh, huge. Like they could really use that to like, I don't know, fill up the entire stands. Like
absolutely, yeah. Even if it's not in either Serbia or United Kingdom, I'm pretty sure people are going to show up just for that. Yeah. Even though I'm pretty sure a lot of people will definitely be thinking that it's not going to be much of a... They're not going to have high hopes there's going to be much of a match, but it could be still. Who knows?
Yeah.
Davis Cup tends to bring a lot from players, so it could be a good match.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I look forward to seeing how Turin plays out with the groups and who ends up taking that big title. Of course, this week we also have Metz and Sofia. Kind of lower stakes because the qualifications have already been
it's already over,
decided. Yeah. But I want to see, like, I'm looking forward to seeing, like, we'll see if, like, Jack Draper can win his first title in Sofia. There's, like, Jack Draper going for his first title. There's Jan de Nootstroef. Hachinov will probably try to win Metz again. Or not again, but just win another title this year because he already won an earlier one.
Yeah.
In Zhuhai. So, yeah, there's some kind of lore... Like stories at the 250 level this week that will be cool for those individual players, and then you got the Billie Jean King Cup this week as well with Canada actually doing really well so far. Yeah. So
good match today between Leila and Sariba Stormo. Almost 3 hours.
The best in each other.
Yeah.
I mean, Sariba Stormo also just brings out the best in a lot of players.
And a lot of players. Yeah.
Yeah. Grinds and defense and
It's just tough to get the ball past her and some It's nuts. It's a really good tournament, honestly. Like I really enjoy watching those team tournaments. Hopefully they get a little bit more going on for them in the future. Top players going in. Hopefully Świątek can play for Poland at some point. Something that she's even complaining
about. That's one of my wishes for next year. If we can get that scheduling slot right.
Yeah.
And we can we could have had Pagula, Goff, and Świątek also playing this week along with Krejcikova and Rybakina. No, we would have had most of the top 10 right there.
Yeah.
So that I think is something the WTA is going to look to do next year along with their finals.
Yeah.
And we'll know more ahead of time where it's going to be, and then it will just help it flow a lot better organizationally. But I think, still with the names that we have in the Billie Jean King Cup, it'll still be fun to watch.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's already fun. So.
Yeah, Canada and even the US has a decently strong team without Pagula and Goff. So, I look forward to seeing how the team events play out. There's still next gen finals coming up where Arthur Fils will be the number one seed.
Yeah.
So, we're not going to have, Shelton or obviously Runa and those other guys. Massetti as well. We're not going to have, but we're going to be able to see like some more new faces that we'll see much more of at the top. And from the marketing standpoint, that event has been pretty successful, I would say.
Yeah,
in terms
for sure.
of, like, you look at the years and the lineups, it's usually translated pretty well. Although not so much for Brandon Nakashima this year with some injuries in the first half of the year, but it did work out very well for the Hechka, who lost in the final. He had a pretty good year. So,
All right. We'll see what happens in the team events and the final in Turin. And just try to follow a little bit of the smaller events as well this week without burning out too much. But
Yeah.
So yeah, I can
almost through. We're almost there. Yeah. the final stretch where we can have our wonderfully long off season,
which is the 3 weeks for season.
Which is like, yeah, tennis basically never stops. So
yeah,
there's just living, talking, breathing tennis that we do here.
Yeah, crazy stuff. All right, so thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for joining again this week. Of course, you're a part of this podcast, so it's always good to have, you know, maybe one day you can get like us three together. Shout out to Owen as well. You can follow us on our social media. Varsh is at Varsh2K, Owen's at Tennis Nation, I'm at Rolandberg Andre, and we are at Tennis and Bagels. And we'll see you guys next time. See ya.
Yeah, cheers. Yeah.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.